This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. Today, a real treat for the show. We've got Emily Adden. She is the outgoing president of the Planning Institute of British Columbia. She's an adjunct professor at UBC School of Community and Regional Planning. And she's also held former positions as the director of planning at the City of New West, as well as senior planning positions with the City of Langford and City of North Vancouver. So, well-decorated planner.
She knows what she's talking about.
Yes.
And Adam, here's a question for you. When's the last time we've had a planner? I mean, I was thinking Gil Kelly, Larry Beasley was on the show a bunch of times.
Yep.
But it's been...
it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Holly Softy, remember that?
Holly Softy, that was episode two.
Yeah, that was a while back.
Where he is now.
We've had some fantastic planners.
Yeah, we have. But here's the thing. It was great having Emily on because I feel like we haven't spoken to a planner in basically since COVID. And it was good to kind of check in what's changed since COVID, what stayed the same, what will forever stay the same about cities, but also her favorite neighborhoods, sleeper neighborhoods that she loves in Metro Vancouver a lot. And last but not least, and this was one of the reasons we were excited to have on a planner, to talk about the role of technology in changing cities and what that means for the future. So stay tuned for this. This is a great conversation with Emily Adden.
Well, if you've been following Vancouver and changes in Vancouver and zoning related changes, I mean, there's lots of stuff that has happened in the past few years. We've covered a lot of it on the show.
Including Lime scooters, which come up in this conversation.
Yeah. Honestly, hey, I filled you in on, you hadn't been on a Lime scooter.
I was on one to your house on Sunday. It was, no word of a lie, fantastic experience.
It's a very good experience.
It cost $4. I was zooming down the bike route on the scooter. I got out of my car. It was like, I forgot about it.
The stations are everywhere.
Yeah. I was actually worried that I was like, okay, I got to find a station. It was like three at the end of your block.
Really. No, I know. And if you can't find a station, you just ghost ride it right into the bushes. that's not true. Anyways, I can't wait for this, Matt. But before we get to this conversation with Emily, a couple things. This podcast today is sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our team in Vancouver.
That's right.
And of course, we have this segment that still remains nameless. This is a trivia segment about Vancouver, Vancouver real estate, or potentially really anything that you come up with.
That's right. This week, Adam.
Yes.
I have what I would think is a fairly easy one, but no pressure. No pressure at all. Yeah. So I'm looking at stats on rental prices.
Okay.
From July 2024 to July 2025. I don't think this is a surprise. There's declining rents across the board. But Adam, which has declined more? Is it one bed apartments in Vancouver, or is it two bedroom apartments in Vancouver, percentage wise?
I'm gonna go with two.
Wait, don't even start, Adam, because we have a listing that we want to talk about over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yes, we do, Matt. I can't wait. This is such an exciting listing. This is unit 403 at 150 Alexander Street in Gastown. Super exciting heritage loft at the historic Mission House. This is fully restored with over $100,000 spent on 2025 renovations. This is beautiful. It's got the old growth beams throughout. It's got a beautiful modern kitchen, great light, beautiful windows. It's a stunning place and two beds, one bath. And again, what a spot. It's a super convenient spot.
You know, we don't talk about value very often, Adam, but it's 1,096 square feet. The asking price is $749,900. That's what, high 600s a foot?
Unbelievable.
When is the last time you could talk about sub $700 a foot, not only in Vancouver, but in historic Gaston.
I know. And you're steps to awesome cafes, world-class restaurants.
Here's another thing I just wanted to say that I'm embarrassed to admit, but we'll admit here. Did you not think the Alibi Room closed? Did it not close?
I didn't know.
No. It's open.
You know, I met my wife at the Alibi Room.
I did not.
Yeah, that was where we met.
Wow. Still going strong after all these years, the Alibi Room.
3 weeks before we met on Tinder. Good one. It was a chance meeting at the Alibi Room. But, wow.
The old way. Nobody meets like
sharing
that anymore.
Sharing a table. Yeah, no kidding.
Is that right? Just sharing a table?
Well, no, we had mutual friends.
Okay. All right. I had never heard this.
Oh, okay. Well, here, back to the trivia.
We don't really talk outside the podcast. Yeah,
exactly. All right.
No, but so Adam, before we get to the trivia, I just want to say it's at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com to check out that listing and all our other featured listings. While you're there, click sell with us. You can download the sold plan. This is start on launch date, our most downloaded document of all time to help you get your property ready for market. And we'd love to work with you. Click sell with us and that document shows up immediately in your inbox.
Now, two beds. Going two beds.
Okay, you're going two beds. Any guess on the percentage decline?
Ooh, that's tricky. But I'm going to say it's probably more substantial than people think.
Jeez. This is according to Zumper.
Oh, Zumper.
Who controls PadMapper.
I find that the data, though...
Well, I think, and actually next week's guest, Ben Myers, talks about this, that it's still data fragmented, stuff, right? Yeah. It's tough.
I'm going to say,
does Zumper factor into your calculations?
Oh man, I'm going to go 15%.
Whoa.
10%.
Whoa. 3%?
No,
it's 8.4%.
Higher than that though. It's higher in real life. It's higher than that.
I think on the ground, you're probably right. 8.4% is what Zumper says. 5.9% for one beds. The interest
is higher than that for one beds.
Yeah. But here's the interesting thing. From June to July, according to this data, two beds continued to suffer a decline where one beds ticked up last month.
Oh, really?
So, you know, we'll see. I don't know. There's some kind of interesting news in last month's stats in both the resale and rental market. So
I wonder what ChatGPT would say about that. But it would actually probably consult Zumper. But speaking of ChatGPT, I heard you had some pretty bad, skinny fat news.
I had, it's funny, two things. One was, is everyone using ChatGPT for health? As a dietitian and
trainer
and the coach and everything else? We've been charting a lot of exercise data over the last couple of years. I uploaded everything, put in all my information. I said, okay, be totally honest, an honest assessment. A lot of it was outdated, my information. I feel like it was kind of 2023 information.
And you're in better shape.
Yeah, was,
go on.
Anyway, no, the first thing it said was, my brutal, honest assessment is you're skinny fat,
that's a tough diagnosis.
That's a tough diagnosis. And then I literally uploaded, I took a photo. I'm the first one. I came up with this.
I took
a photo of myself
physique.
In the mirror, you know, but most people, I put it on Instagram. No, yeah. I took a photo. Then I took a side profile and I uploaded those.
And it used the photo as a footnote for the skinny fat.
No, it said you're fat.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, it didn't. It actually, it was a better assessment. Turns out it was outdated information. But I told this to somebody at the office who did the same thing.
Yeah.
Guy in his early 50s. First line back, you look like you're in relatively decent shape for a guy in his late 50s to early 60s.
Wow.
So don't try this at home.
So what was the for people at home that are inevitably going to try this, what was the prompt? You just said
I set up a project and the
fitness project.
Project. And my prompt was something about your, world-class dietitian and fitness coach or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here's the type of things I ate. We had those body scans done. I uploaded those.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's amazing how the analysis based on the photos was pretty bang on, I think. And then also, I was looking because we did these DEXA scans.
Oh, wow.
Two years ago or whatever. Yeah. I was like, man, I can't find that. I want to upload it. So I was going back in my photos. I found a similar photo of me at the beach 2 years ago, uploaded that, said, this is 2 years ago, compare. And it gave like a fairly accurate comparison. So,
wow.
Kind of interesting stuff. But yeah, can you imagine our colleague there early 60s.
Now I'm scared to do mine. Yeah.
One like thing you're cute sure, for, keep your pants on.
You're cute. You're cute for a grandpa. Yeah. Okay, here we go. This is our conversation with Emily Adden. She's fantastic, and it's nice to talk to a planner these days.
Yeah, no kidding. So enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been nominated for Multifamily Builder of the Year for 10 consecutive years and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with 2 fitness areas, 3 children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Emily Adden. She is the outgoing president of the Planning Institute of British Columbia, adjunct professor at UBC School of Community and Regional Planning, and former director of planning at the City of New West, and has held senior planning positions with the City of Langford and the City of North Vancouver. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Emily.
It's my pleasure, Adam. It's great to be with you this morning.
Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I mean, I'm a West Coast gal through and through. I've lived everywhere from Los Angeles to the Alaska Highway and many points in between. And I've been an urban planner for, over a quarter century of experience now. So I love urban living. I love living in an urban village, and I'm attracted to rural areas too, and not much in between in terms of some suburban environments that I've seen. And I'm just, I'm thrilled to be able to spend a lot of time writing, thinking, and speaking about urban planning and my passion for all things planning these days.
And why planning, Emily?
So I think I already hinted that I've seen the worst of suburbia. I won't tell you which suburb of Ottawa I grew up in, but hopefully my parents won't hear this podcast. But I think I've seen the worst of suburbia when I was a kid, and it worked for me when I was a kid. But as I became a teenager, I knew I needed something more. I was looking for that sense of belonging that really good urban fabric brings. And when I landed in Europe at 18 years old, I saw some of that urban fabric that I was looking for. And it got my mind racing. It got me, I think, on the path of becoming an urban planner, was those kind of formative experiences and just really wanting to be part of finding those solutions to creating great neighborhoods and great cities.
That's great. Maybe as a launching off point, Emily, what makes Metro Vancouver unique as a planning region in Canada?
I think it's unique in part because of the natural constraints on development, how we're encircled by mountains and water and good agricultural land and the U.S. border, to be honest. I think that makes us very unique. I think the agricultural land reserve constraint has really created urban containment as well, to a greater extent than other cities in Western Canada at a really formative time of the region. So I think that makes us very unique. We don't see the same kind of sprawl that you might see in other places in Western Canada and the Western United States.
So it's an interesting, the idea of the agricultural land reserve happening at kind of a formative moment. Is urban containment, in your mind, a positive thing?
It is. And I know I could differ from some developers there. Not all developers, really, and maybe some in the real estate community as well. I do know that it can create a financial constraint, economic constraint that can add to issues of affordability and that we need to do it well. We need to constrain urban areas in the right way, in the right places, and offer opportunities so that we don't have housing supply challenges and housing affordability challenges. But it really also affords us the ability to lower our carbon footprint and to create more livable communities with great public transit that anyone of any income would be happy to use. One of the things I see when I'm in Europe is people in suits, well-off people with Rolexes using the metro. There's really no stigma about using public transit in many parts of the world that you see in other places. And I think we'd have a much more livable region the more and more that we subscribe to that kind of way of looking at living.
Is Vancouver the most European city in North America, in your mind?
I wouldn't say so. Montreal, for example, I think is probably a top contender, perhaps Quebec City as well, and maybe some of the cities in northeast area of the States. I think there's urban villages in Toronto that remind me of some places in Europe. And I don't want to slag Ottawa too much. As much as I didn't appreciate some of the suburban life I had when I was growing up, Ottawa's done some urbanism well in some places as well. So I wouldn't say that. No, we have something special here, a real Pacific Rim kind of living that marries access to green space, access to nature, with, I think, a lot of urban villages. I think we have urban centers throughout our region that are quite successful.
In that same line, Emily, what is Metro Vancouver getting right from a planning perspective?
So, as I said, the urban containment is a benefit as much as it creates some pain in some quarters. And I also think we have superb transit. There's much room for improvement, absolutely. But what we don't realize when we're complaining about transit sometimes in Vancouver is that elsewhere in North America, people are looking at our region as a beacon of good public transit. And they're coming to see what we've done and they're coming to learn from what we've done. So I think we've done that well. And as I mentioned before, the dispersed density in urban centers across the region, I think, is a great quality of a great city. And a lot of other cities like Copenhagen, that is very well known for good planning, also has the disparate density at a distance from the core business district.
You know, Emily, well, maybe I don't want to say you have alluded to it earlier in the conversation, but what in your mind are the biggest and ongoing challenges for the region?
So I think one of the biggest challenges, and it relates maybe more to how provincial legislation is set up than anything else, is how loose a federation Metro Vancouver is. The regulation is pretty loose in terms of how all of these different authorities in the region of different sizes, of different makeup entirely, with different features, need to work together as a region. And really what they need to rely on is moral suasion. They need to be politicians with one another and sort of very gently twist each other's arms to get to the finish line with any regional policy. To some degree, that's good. To some degree, you know, that's how democracy works. Everyone's trying to represent their own constituency and negotiate with others at the table. But sometimes I bemoan that the challenge that there's not enough of an incentive to play ball, to mix metaphors, as I often do, as regional actors at the same table.
Do you see, like I'm just thinking here, you know, the idea of urban villages or villages kind of within the city, I think that's something that, you know, we've kind of talked about on the show. And I think Adam and I both love about the city of Vancouver. I'm just wondering, based on what you're saying, with kind of different authorities and this kind of loose federation and this idea of urban villages where people are really entrenched in their neighborhood and love their neighborhood and aren't keen necessarily to see a lot of change. Like, can you talk about how we should go about dealing with what's been kind of an ongoing housing crisis or how you see that playing out? And I'm kind of thinking of this in terms of, you know, the province coming in the last couple of years and basically upzoning across the board, kind of a more top-down authority or a top-down authoritative kind of play that doesn't really jive with like urban villages in my mind. It's a big question, maybe.
It is a big question, and I don't know that I have all the answers, Matt. But I will say that one of the ideas that I'm attracted to, I do think there is an issue and that the province had identified with individual spot rezonings and official community plan amendments that was happening throughout the region and the length of time it would take to get to the finish line with these very individual rezoning processes. And if you can find a way not to cut the public engagement, but to speak very deeply with people about what sort of thing should be permitted as of right, then you get to the finish line with people feeling like they've had their voices heard. And then you have a pre-zoning of an area in order to get the housing supply that you need, in order to get the units that you need, the affordability that you need, the environmental protections that you need. For example, I was involved in the pre-zoning initiative in the city of North Vancouver for the Moodyville area, and that was hugely successful. It was kind of like a unicorn. It was going from single family to multi-story in most parts of Moodyville, you know, 4 to 6 story buildings in one fell swoop without slowly rezoning from single family to duplex to, you know, fourplex or sixplex and then up from there. So I think it's a great measure of success, but we didn't cut corners with the public engagement. We spoke to everyone and we got to the finish line together with everyone. But then we did official community plan changes, rezoning, and sort of fast-tracked approvals of other kinds all at the same time in order to get efficiencies and to get the units built more more quickly.
I feel like Moodyville is actually a real success story. We actually just had a listing over there and it was like, man, this community is really coming to its own.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm proud of that because it's an example of how you get to the finish line in creating a nice neighborhood that's actually supported by the residents and everyone's on board. I think there were by the time we got to public hearing, there was quite a lot of support in the room, if I could put it to you that way.
Emily, do you see opportunities, you know, something like another Moodyville or something entirely different, kind of opportunities or easy wins for the region that we're not taking advantage of right now?
Well, the greatest opportunities I see when things get quieter on the market development front. It's a huge opportunity to play catch up with public housing projects. It's a huge opportunity to play catch up on getting the policy work done that will bring neighborhoods and constituents on side for the development that's to occur. So it's not so much neighborhoods that I think are the opportunities to get redeveloped, although of course those exist as well in the region, especially along the SkyTrain station lines. But it's, you know, let's keep moving, let's keep people busy on the development front, the laborers, let's keep the materials coming in when things slow down with private development, and let's increase the public housing units that are being built. I think that's an incredible opportunity. And I know Metro Vancouver is working really closely with local governments across the region to deliver on redevelopment of sites that they own. And I'm really glad to see that.
It does strike me as a kind of, and I haven't really thought of this, but as a time to kind of move full speed ahead in terms of getting people on board for future projects or future development, right? Even if everything feels a little stagnant right now.
That's right. And usually you have enough generalists on staff. I mean, I've worked for more kind of medium and smaller, dense urban cities in BC. And I've had the luxury, I think, when things slow down on the development front, to get those same staff playing catch up on the policy front and on the long range planning front. Because sometimes when your hair's on fire and you're trying to get as many units built as possible, and people do not understand how hard public servants work. I think some of those outdated stereotypes about us are, I'm not there anymore, but I was in the trenches for 20 years in public service. Those stereotypes are out of date, but you know, getting calls at all hours from politicians and developers and trying to get those units built. When you have a bit of a pause on that, that's your opportunity to play catch up and to get everyone on board with redeveloping, for example, in New Westminster around the 22nd Street station. You know, they're going big, they're going bold in New Westminster, and it's really a good opportunity to have those big conversations with the community when things slow down on the development front.
I'm just thinking about neighborhoods. This is kind of I was thinking about New West because I feel like at a certain point in the history of our show, we were talking about New West all the time as this really exciting place where you can, you know, head into Surrey. It's like connected, right? It's like this little kind of almost village that is connected to the rest of the region in a way that a lot of other places aren't. What is your favorite neighborhood in Metro Vancouver? And this is not to say New West. Favorite neighborhoods you think are not getting enough attention. And that's kind of where I was drawing on the New West. So maybe I'll just put it, you know, as somebody who's worked in the region for a long time and has a different perspective than we do, for sure, I'm kind of curious on kind of sleeper neighborhoods and what where you really like.
Well, it's interesting, Matt, because when I started working at City of Langford in 2005, developers had already just discovered it relatively recently ahead of that time that I joined them. But it had been sort of the butt of jokes. And up until relatively recently before I joined, same thing happened when I joined City of North Vancouver in 2009. It had recently been discovered by the development community. And I would say the same is true for New Westminster. There was a lot of criticism in the region of some of these places. And yet, now they are shining jewels, I think, in the region, especially, I would say, Lower Lonsdale area of the city of North Vancouver. It's done incredibly well. And I think there are still people in the region that aren't visiting and don't realize what a great walkable place that it is and how successful it's become. But to be, I guess, more inward focused in answer to your first question about what my favorite neighborhood is, it's really my own. It's really the area known as the Drive by the locals, by which I mean Commercial Drive or the Grandview Woodland areas, I guess is what the city of Vancouver calls it. And we all call it the Drive. I think it's special. I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to grow up there. I mean, I'm not growing up there. My kids are, but they're getting to know. I feel like I'm growing up in a way at all times. But my kids get to know, you know, local shopkeepers by their first names and bring them, you know, holiday cards and get to roam the neighborhoods and pick up groceries for us, even at relatively young ages, when we run out of something while we're cooking dinner. So I think there's this liveliness and vibrancy that I'm just so thrilled that my kids get to experience as they grow up.
Fantastic. And what about, it is true though, right? That I feel like there's a history to that neighborhood that is... that when you go to some, like an up and coming neighborhood or some other neighborhoods, even in Vancouver, you can feel there's a depth to the neighborhood around Commercial Drive that is kind of really attractive in my mind.
I think it exists elsewhere, and I probably just haven't had the experience yet of some of the neighborhoods in the region. And I understand why people are in love with neighborhoods elsewhere, but the Drive is where I'm at. And it's I'm thrilled every day to walk out my front door and be in that neighborhood.
Fantastic. And is there, in your travels, another neighborhood area around Metro Vancouver that you think is exciting that doesn't seem to be on a lot of people's radars?
Steveston Village, I think. I was really pleased to visit some of the old areas in the old village areas in Langley recently. I really enjoy several of the neighborhoods in New Westminster. I think great things are happening there. As I mentioned, Lower Lonsdale areas is, I think, very special in the region. But I think there's pockets of urban villages across the North Shore that can be discovered. I've also lived in some areas of Kitsilano and Strathcona and Kerrisdale. And I think some of them are achieving some measure of revival after, you know, facing challenges with aging demographics. I think some families are moving back into some of those areas and creating more of a neighborly feel.
Right. Yeah. Ongoing for sure. Emily, as an urbanist and somebody who, if I can call you that, and somebody who really loves kind of this kind of walkable neighborhoods and the idea of, I guess, a 15-minute city presumably is something that excites you. I'm curious to hear how you think, or what you think the kind of longer term impact of COVID is or will be on Metro Vancouver, and just the Coles Notes version, of course. And we saw it quite dramatically in the real estate community, where, you know, a lot of people either moved further afield to get space to work from home. They didn't have to commute in, so looking for larger space, looking for yards. But it was essentially, in my mind, you know, some people actually just went to smaller towns, but a lot of people, it just was a kind of a push to the suburbs, right? Do you see that as a trend that will continue, or was that kind of a blip because of the nature of what we were facing?
I see it more as a blip, Matt, for sure, because almost everything that we've seen in terms of differences that occurred at the beginning of the pandemic, I think we've seen rebound from some of those dynamics in a major way. Even with regards to remote work, more and more employers are wanting workers to come back into the office. They've figured out they're losing something, and they're figuring out they need to find a way to bring back some of those dynamics that created more collaboration between different work groups and teams and more connection between their employees in terms of, I guess, being less bureaucratic and officious and getting to the finish line with bright ideas more quickly. One of the ways in which I think we won't go back is that I think we're still spending more time outdoors. I think a lot of people discovered the outdoors, and by which I don't just mean access to nature, although that's part of it, even access to out walking around a neighborhood, exploring patio life in a new way. I don't think that's going anywhere. I think, for example, you know, it's been decades that people, even in Scandinavia, in cold climates, were enjoying patio living, even on cold days of the year. It was not a big deal to see a big box with wool blankets and people hanging outdoors of cafes and restaurants. And I think with COVID, in many places of North America, people discovered it's not so bad to have more outdoor living, even when you're enjoying a coffee with friends or a drink after work in the great outdoors, rather than and being ensconced inside of cafes and restaurants.
You know what? I was actually in Europe over the winter for the first time. And I was actually, it's funny you say that because I wasn't in Scandinavia, but it was cold enough out that I was not interested in staying outside. And I was shocked in places, you know, like Spain, where it was still like kind of Vancouverish, like 10 above maybe. And people were almost to a person on patios. As opposed to being in the restaurants.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting point that I've never really thought of. And maybe it speaks to kind of that idea of, and I don't know much about it, but the third space or whatever, this kind of, because yeah. The other thing I was struck by was how much people still live outdoors. Like people still sit on park benches and just sit there and watch people go by in a way that you don't see here, which is kind of really attractive, I think.
That's right. And I do think it happens here, maybe to a lesser extent. And planners have learned the hard way that people want to watch other people. You know, sometimes park benches were turned away from the path and people thought, oh, everyone's going to want to look at the trees. No, everyone wants to sit and look at people of all ages enjoying the park, playing ball, climbing the jungle gym, you know, roller skating by. People want to look at people, even if it's a completely anonymized experience. And sometimes we seek that, actually. We need a break from, you know, a busy day, but we still want to watch. We still want to watch the world go by. And I think that's been well understood in urban areas of Europe much sooner than it was in North America.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep. And you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
Can you talk about how good planning kind of creates those environments? And I'm thinking mainly from the idea that it seems like it's kind of come up in Europe, and maybe this is my impression, I might be totally wrong, that it's kind of has come up from time immemorial. The cities have emerged the way they are, and people use them in a certain way. But like in Vancouver, I was just out, and it was actually a great experience. I met Darren Kwiatkowski from Shape Properties out at the amazing Brentwood. He's just walking me mm-hmm. around, and I was shocked at how that public square by the SkyTrain with the fountain. And it was a nice day, but like there was kids playing ping pong. There was people walking. Like it was like this really vibrant place. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of actual planning to create those spaces?
Yes. I mean, I'm speaking a lot about Europe because I'm writing a book on Europe right now. But I do want to disabuse you of the notion. I've seen good planning all over the world, including in Canada, I haven't been to that place in Brentwood, but I believe you that great planning's occurred. And I mean, how it happens, you bring the variety of voices to the table, the variety of expertise, and you collaborate to create something special that reflects that place. One of the things that's happening in the world that's, I guess, a counterpoint to that at times is the globalization of placemaking, to the extent sometimes that you see the exact same thing in one part of the world as many other parts of the world without reflecting the sense of place of that location. So that's a counterpoint. But in bringing together all of these voices and paying attention to public space, those third places, like you said, the outdoor living rooms of these people who are otherwise in their own individual households, in their own individual units, that's where the kismet happens. That's where people meet either with people they know, or they start getting to know their neighbors because they see them over and over again in those outdoor public spaces, or just enjoys each other's company anonymously. That's I think the magic of good city planning, of good neighborhood planning, of good placemaking, is that vitality that you can get to when all of these different disciplines are working closely together and there's support for good placemaking. There's not cost-cutting in the placemaking.
It is kind of, I had a question for you, and it's like, it kind of makes me think of this, you know, it's a comedian asking the you know, where do you get your ideas from? Which is like this kind of silly question. But I was thinking about this because it kind of speaks to exactly what you're talking about, right? There's all these areas of the world to draw inspiration from, but to kind of localize them, right? To take ideas of things that have worked elsewhere, but to make it something specific to Vancouver. Like, you kind of spoke about that a little bit there, but how does that work in your kind of, you said, quarter of a century in the planning community, drawing on good ideas from elsewhere and actually implementing them in kind of really effective ways in Vancouver?
I mean, I think it's different for different planners, but I would say any planners worth their salt always have their radar up. We don't need to recreate anything from scratch because there's so many great things happening around the world and even around the region, and we should be attuned to them. I recently, just in May actually, was on a city planning field school to the city state of Singapore, and really had the opportunity to meet with people working at a high level in the Urban Redevelopment Authority and the Housing and Development Board. So really senior officials who brought us on neighborhood tours and showed us projects and inspired all of the planners who joined in. Half of us were from British Columbia, half of us from Alberta, and got to see, you know, Singapore's version of good city planning and ask the questions that needed to be asked in order to imagine how this idea, that idea, this idea could be translated back to our home cities. And writing things, I get my hand cramps up because I get so excited and writing everything down, bringing those ideas and then talking to the people you need to talk to get them to open their minds to doing things differently in this region and in these neighborhoods.
Maybe in that regard, do you see, or maybe more broadly, take it however you want, but in terms of kind of tension between, if there is tension between good planning and kind of the realities of the market, like how do you, what are the biggest tensions, I guess, that you see and yeah, just your thoughts.
Sure. Well, there are always trade-offs, and I think as much as some people like to say we can always get to win-win in any negotiations, in any development projects, there are always trade-offs. So there are tensions there. There's tensions between being really comprehensive and being really efficient, you know, creating good neighborhoods to some extent and getting units built quickly and getting the highest profits on the projects. I do think that if everyone can come to the table and speak with each other in good faith and put on the table what their sort of minimum needs are to bring back in order to get approval, you can get to the finish line in a way that everyone can be proud of at the end of the day. If you're asking too much of a developer and the project never gets built, you haven't actually succeeded because the housing units that you were looking to build, the public amenities that you were looking to provide to the neighborhood never come to pass. Or they don't come into being for many years because the economics just don't work. So I feel like I'm half avoiding your question because the complexity of the trade-offs is really high of mind for me right now, and I think it really depends on the project exactly what the trade-offs are, but they inevitably exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like, and we've talked to a lot of people, obviously from the development community, that are quite vocal right now about community amenity contribution, you know, CACs and DCCs, and the list goes on. You know, from the outside looking in, or from the perspective of the guy who asked the questions and not much else, in my mind, it feels like we are kind of going gangbusters for so long. Right, that it's like everything got the asks got bigger and bigger, and I think the one that I always think of is Northeast False Creek. Like the idea there was like this kind of stunning, you know, the viaducts are coming down and a park, and that was just, that plan seemed amazing, and I'm not even sure where it's at right now, but my impression is that won't be happening for decades, if it ever happens at all, with the new hospital and everything else. Of course, the hospital is being built, but yeah, we're in a challenging moment for sure. From your perspective, should development pay for development?
Well, I do think growth should pay for growth. Maybe that's a different way of saying the same thing. Growth should pay for growth. But I might make myself unpopular, I guess, with some senior planners in the region to say that sometimes growth is paying for growth that doesn't belong to that particular project, if I could put it to you that way. I do think municipalities are constrained. I think that it's incredibly hard to find ways to pay for the infrastructure deficit, and that anyone moving into a neighborhood with a new development is also going to suffer from the lack of wide enough pipes or, proper sidewalks. So I do think it's sometimes been on the backs of the new developers coming in to a neighborhood to pay for the improvements that are needed or the infrastructure deficit, frankly, that absolutely needs to be addressed. But I think the problem is more probably economic. It's the way that municipalities' means of financing these kind of improvements are too constrained, to be honest. So I feel for the municipalities because I've been there. And I know that there are some means of paying for improvements, for example, in some cities of the United States that are not available to any of the cities in this region, that aren't available to any cities in British Columbia. And that kind of constraint is going to have repercussions for the development industry that are beyond, to some extent, the municipality's control.
Mm. And it strikes me as something that's kind of almost, I see it from both sides, but generational in a way, that it's in a lot of cases, newcomers to a neighborhood buying newer construction, which presumably not always, but are often younger people, young families, that are being made to pay for the upgrades. And I guess I can, my neighbor's been in my neighborhood for 45, 50 years. I guess the argument on his side is, why should my property taxes go up so somebody can live down the street from me, But it's, I feel like it's a, yeah, it's in, we're in a tough spot, I guess, is my thought.
We're in a tough spot and we have to get more creative, which luckily all levels of government are aware of. They might not agree on the solutions, but we're all, I think we've all been aware that something's broken and needs fixing. So at least we're on board with each other in that way.
Right. Maybe switching gears a little bit, Emily, I'm curious to hear how you're thinking about, and maybe even how you and how I know you teach at UBC, how maybe your students too are thinking about the role of technology in the future of Metro Vancouver and in planning more generally. And the kind of logic of this question is, we had somebody on the show months ago now, I think it was Justin Smith, and he was saying he was just thinking out loud about self-driving cars. Right. And how there won't, electric self-driving cars, you can feel good about riding in the back of one. Your commute is probably more efficient because you're able to be productive. There won't be as many traffic jams. This opens up spaces to live that you wouldn't have considered before. And in some ways, it's that idea of what's attractive, I think, is the opposite of probably what we think is attractive, talking about urban villages. But I'm curious to just hear, it seems like things are changing so quickly. How do you account for that? And what does it look like in shaping the future of Metro Van?
Thanks for the question. Although I guess I'm saying that semi-sarcastically. I think my students would... you brought up my students. I think my students would really laugh because I'm not as good at technological things as most of their instructors. It's pretty ironic as well. I'm really keen on reading paper books and pen to paper and good old fashioned non-electronic things. Semi Luddite, if you will, even though both my parents were among the two first computer scientists in Canada, that gene didn't get passed on to me. So I think my students would really laugh. But on the other hand, I would say I'm not one of those people that is saying that AI should be or could be a fad. I think it's here to stay. And I think that technological transformation is inevitable. We see things moving very, very quickly. I will half answer your question, I suppose, by saying I think what's really incredibly important here and elsewhere, so this region and elsewhere, is to find ways to outsmart the machines before they outsmart us. And what I mean by that, you know, if you look elsewhere in the world, there are some places where you've seen really bottom up smart city transformations, for example, in Barcelona, where they have something they call technological sovereignty, where the smart city technology has been co-created with community. And you juxtapose that to some of what we've been seeing elsewhere, which is very top down. And it feels more uncomfortable. Where it's top down, it feels more uncomfortable because you don't know where all this information that's being gathered about the way that you move through a city or what's being picked up, I suppose, by your iPhone, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes I'm not talking to it and it seems to hear what I what I'm yeah. saying because it
you're not alone.
Pops in with comments. But, you know, I think that we need to fundamentally ask ourselves what's changing, what will the results be, and how can we shape this change to best work for the people who live in this region?
Mm-hmm. Do you think, like, part of me, and I might, it might be wishful thinking, but part of me thinks humans live the way they do because we need kind of community and connection. And we like, you know, for the many people like to live in where you can walk down the street and talk to the local grocer or whatever, or use the SkyTrain. There seems like technology, apart from self-driving calls like cars, the multimodal transportation that we have in the city seems to be helping in some ways, like those Lime scooters. I used mm-hmm. one on the weekend for the first time. And it was like, this is like, you know, I took it to a park where I met a bunch of families. And it was like, this is a great, it's just, it yeah. makes my life easier. But do you think kind of the way, this is maybe a huge question, do you think the way we actually live will change? Like this idea of self-driving cars allowing me to live out in the middle of nowhere as an attractive kind of component. I don't know. Do you think planning the role of the city changes maybe?
I hope not, but I also think not. I think people were thinking that they could get the same sort of living experience by moving to exurbia. And I think people are finding that's just not the case. And I think downtowns and urban villages are becoming popular again the world over. I think some of those assumptions about what might change will be proven wrong. I honestly do. I've been doing research. I told you a bit about writing a book on Europe. Well, I actually visited the site, the ruins of the first city in the world. And what's really fascinating about that city is that the archaeologists couldn't find any reason, all of the assumptions around why people would come together in a city proved not to pan out. So it wasn't for agriculture. It hadn't been invented yet. It wasn't for domestic animals herding. That hadn't been sort of introduced yet, et cetera. It wasn't for self-defense, et cetera, et cetera. So as best that they can find for this city, the reason it came about, and it was a small city, but large for its time, 9,000 years ago, 8,000 people, was just that sense of connection. And people were living in very close proximity and in close density. There wasn't even city streets invented yet. And all of the homes were uptight against each other, and people were getting from home to home across the rooftops. And that's how they traveled, was across the roofscape. I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but I'm excited about this stuff. I just wanted to share really with you, Matt, that people, that is the very beginning of cities in the world. is that people want it to feel connected, and it just doesn't do it for us. As much as I enjoy talking to you this morning, I would love it even more, I'm sure, if we were with each other in person. It's just right. Got a different feeling to it than this two-dimensional world. And as we discovered during COVID, there's only so far you can go with that sense of community in a completely digital world.
Well, maybe that's a good place to end it. That was great. Bet on cities, Emily, is my takeaway from that. But I love that there's certain kind of fundamentally human things that will withstand whatever is thrown at us. I'd like to think that that's the case as well. I hope you're right, but it makes a lot of sense. We do have this segment called the Five Wire, five lighthearted questions to end the show. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Sure. Absolutely.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure, an all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's JETHRO condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours. Okay, one book you've read recently that you would recommend to our listeners.
Sure. It is A Field Guide to Getting Lost by Rebecca Solnit. It's an oldie but a goodie. She mixes critique and personal experience, and I just loved getting into the weeds with her on that.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's one I haven't heard of. All right. We've never had that one. That's great. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Okay, so when I worked with municipalities, I read so much for work that I had kind of lost a lot of the skill of reading for pleasure. And since leaving my position at City of New Westminster 2 years ago, I read omnivorously at least an hour every morning, everything under the sun, and most evenings as well, I read again. So it's, I guess, a newly discovered pleasure.
It's, you know what? I feel like I aspire to it. I aspire to it. I can't say I've rediscovered it. I used to read a lot. That's something I can say. in a totally different direction. Anything you've been binge watching lately or a movie recommendation?
My kids would probably ask me to own up to my deep dedication to zombie movies, but and shows, but they'd ask me to fess up. But I think I'll talk instead about. I recently saw a series on Netflix. It was called The Residence, and I thought it was very, very intelligent, but also highly entertaining. It was funny. It was engaging. I loved that show.
Fantastic. Okay, The Residents. And favorite band or music recommendation?
Ooh, I love the wild mixes. Any kind of wild mix, like, you know, rock and disco together, or punk and disco, really, like The Rapture, or electro pop and new wave. The Empire of the Sun is one of my favorite bands right now. Any kind of wild mix, two different genres of music mashed together, and I'm there for it.
Okay. And last but not least, something you have purchased for under $1,500 that has had a positive impact in your on your life in the last few years.
I'm going to sound out a character here. It's very, very non-urban. Pretty recently, I bought a red cedar canoe that I had wanted my whole life. I had always wanted a red cedar canoe, and I have it now. And it's one of those, it's strange because it's an inanimate object that gives me joy every time I think about it. So it changed my life.
That's great. That's great. Okay. Well, Emily, we thank you so much for your time. And as somebody listening probably has noticed, Adam had technological issues and dropped from the call and didn't get back on, unfortunately. But how can people find out more about what you're doing? We know you're writing a book about Europe. That sounds really great. And I know you have a website, but how can people follow along?
Yeah, I mean, it's still in progress, but I think the easiest way to find it, because you might not be able to spell my name, is urbancurious.com is where you should go. And I mean, I'm working really hard on switching my focus. I still work as a consultant in planning. I still am all things urban planning, but I'm also writing about it and speaking about it. So if people want to stay engaged and find out more about what I'm up to when my articles come out and when my book comes out, please come to my website and I'll share with you. Not very much. I hate those sites that send you way too much to your inbox and it gets overwhelming. So I promise not to be one of those, but I'll keep in touch.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Emily Adden, outgoing president of the Planning Institute of BC, adjunct prof at UBC School of Community and Regional Planning, former director of planning at the City of New West. And of course, she's held multiple other positions. An urbanist, I would say, and very interesting person to talk to. I enjoyed that a lot.
I feel like I wonder what, she used some language there that's probably more current with urban planners, but I feel like, do people still say urbanite?
I think that just means somebody who lives in a city. You missed part of the interview, unfortunately. Yeah. For the first time ever.
Because I feel like there's always different names coming up for like,
you're like,
urban geographer. I'm a, what do you call those?
Urban anthropologist?
I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
I live in a smart city.
Yeah, you know, one thing we did talk about 15-minute cities.
Or a happy city.
Oh, yeah.
Happy city. We've had
Charles Montgomery.
Charles Montgomery on the show. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, actually. Need somebody to get back, actually.
Yeah, no, it was a happy city. You know what's funny, though, is there's a lot of great cities. I was reading this. There's an article, I should link to it, but about how some of the best and most usable cities are not always the happiest cities. So it's questionable if there's a correlation.
Oh, interesting. Well, what I really liked about this was a few things. One, kind of the COVID and the, what does the city, how does technology change the city? I kind of hope Emily's right, but I think she's right about the COVID, that we're kind of seeing a resurgence of, you know, people wanting to be connected, community, back in urban villages and urban spaces. And, you know, there's some, and like I said, we had those technical difficulties where you miss some of this, but she talks about the oldest city and how, I'll leave this with you to listen back, Adam, but the oldest city and how, you know, people gathered seemingly only to be together and live together communally and have these. So,
but that makes sense to me because you think about like, you know, New West as being like the oldest city, I guess, in the region, right?
Yeah.
And it's very walkable and quite dense.
Right.
And things,
but no, she's
together.
Talking about like 9,000 years ago. Like it wasn't for necessarily for trade, for agriculture. It was like people just came together to live because the only thing they can explain it by is like they wanted to be near other people. And I, she said it in the context of so self-driving cars and these types of things. Like, how does this change? Do people, you know, does everybody try and move, you know,
move away to live remotely because they have
easy... Exactly. And I think the thing is that it's kind of part of the human condition to want to live in spaces that are denser with community and culture and connectivity.
I don't know if we're at that point yet, but it'll be interesting to see kind of the rebound of COVID. I mean, we saw obviously a lot of people that moved away for COVID went and decided, oh, we're going to move to a cabin in the woods or whatever now that we can work remotely. And then they all came kind of, a lot of them came back to the city. There was like a rebound that happened, I feel like maybe 2022-ish, 2023, we'd started seeing people in like opens and stuff where they were like, yeah, we moved to Victoria during COVID. Huge mistake. Now we're coming back to Vancouver. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how long it kind of, maybe the people that are coming back have already come back, but it'll be interesting to see kind of the data around this and the trends around this.
Yeah. Well,
because presumably a lot of people will miss that social connection, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Honestly, not to bring it back to Lime Scooters, but it always comes back to Lime Scooters. A way that technology is really, it's such a great kind of component of, I've only used it once, but something that really is like a technology that is really effective for living in the city in this like great way and aids connectivity.
North like, Van, I don't know if they've got it yet.
Multimodal transportation. North Van is this years ago.
North Van's getting the electric bikes.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's which is a big deal, I think. Cause I mean, I feel like that's something that once you get some kind of a service like that, it increases the value of the neighborhood in terms, not value from a monetary, but more just value. It's like, oh, there's a way better place to live now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we'll see how it plays out. But yeah, it was great having Emily on for sure. What else do we have before we cut for the day? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the Live Wire. This is our weekly mailer where we're sending out stats, sales ratios, where you can dig into the data, find out different price bands and different neighborhoods are selling. We also have, of course, Deal of the Month, but really more importantly for this podcast is Private Client Services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Sign up for your own free account today. It's the best way to monitor the market, especially in a market like this. And Matt, if someone wants to get in touch with you, how can they reach out?
They can reach out at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We'll have a great week and we're back next week with Ben Myers. I can't wait for that episode. He's the president of Bullpen Research and Consulting.
Past guest fan favorite too.
And tons of great data on the rental market, on new construction, and he's calling in from Toronto, which right now is an interesting market.
It's an interesting market. We won't bury the lead. It's a little scarier than Vancouver, I would say.
Absolutely.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.